Hello, and welcome to Recovery Corner, where we introduce you to those making a difference to help you, your family, friends, and neighbors navigate the road to recovery. I'm Jackie Sheehy, Director of Marketing and Partner Relations with AberHealth. I'm delighted to be joined here at the NADCP conference by Melissa Patrick, the Support Services Manager for the Des Moines, Washington Municipal Court, and Darcy Kimu, Program Coordinator for the Cobb County DUI Court in Georgia. Both serve as AberHealth customer ambassadors and have so much experience to share with us today. Welcome, Melissa and Darcy.
Hello.
Hello.
Let's start by telling us more about your roles and what you do to keep your community safe. Melissa, how about we start with you?
Des Moines, Washington is a smaller town just south of Seattle. We are a court of limited jurisdiction, and I am in charge of our probation or our support services department. We monitor mostly misdemeanor DUI offenders, those with substance use disorder issues, and domestic violence crimes.
Great. And Darcy, what about you?
So I'm the program coordinator for the Cobb County DUI Court Program, and that is located in Marietta, Georgia, which is a suburb of Atlanta. I am not native to the area, but I'm acclimating. I've been there for about 12 years. Our program population usually runs in the 60s or 70s. We did struggle a little bit at the peak of COVID, but we've done a really good job of maintaining a healthy population in our program. So we're a fairly large accountability court program and focusing predominantly on multiple offenders.
Great. Great. And what would you say some of the challenges are that you have in your program when it comes to substance use disorder? Darcy, how about we'll start with you this time?
Oh, no. I think recently one of the substance use disorder issues that we really kind of had is just identifying, because everything is self-disclosure initially, identifying really how extensive their substance use is. Certainly drug testing plays a key component in that. If they assess low risk, low needs, but then they continue to test positive for alcohol, that's kind of an indicator to us that perhaps they minimized their use. So...
Okay. Melissa, what about you? Some of the challenges in
being from Washington State and having marijuana legal, that has been a significant issue. We've seen more DUI arrests because of poly substance abuse, marijuana mixed with other drugs. Alcohol also continues to play a problem. We use drug testing because we've noticed a lot of people have moved from their primary substance to secondary substances such as kratom, ketamine, and we're able to test for those now when it wasn't originally disclosed to us that they had ever tried or used those kind of drugs.
Well, you know, we're here at NADCP with professionals from treatment courts. So let's talk a little bit about DUI courts specifically. You know, tell a little bit about what they are and how they work. Darcy, how about we start with you?
So our DUI court program, we target multiple offenders. We are a misdemeanor court, but we don't exclude felonies. So specifically in Georgia, if you have a fourth DUI in a 10-year time frame, then that fourth DUI becomes a felony. We do have a couple of felonies in our program, which is exciting to me because we're building a bridge and expanding our program. But there are other indicators as well, like having a high level of substance use disorder. So assessing at high risk, high needs, or assessing at a severe SUD. Certainly the research indicates that if your BAC at the time of arrest is more than double the legal limit, then you have a high propensity to reoffend. So we do make certain exceptions or exclusions based on those factors as well. We are a minimum of a 12-month program. Our average pre-COVID was about 14 months to get through the program. Post-COVID or during COVID, I like to think that we're post-COVID, but I guess we're not. Since COVID, it has taken significantly longer. I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that most of the treatment has been virtual. So we did go back to in-person therapy, and then the numbers have spiked. So we're doing hybrid therapy. So we're doing as many in-person classes as possible, but it's really based on class size because, like I said, our census is a little bit larger than the other accountability courts in the area. If their phase is a smaller population, then we can do in-person group. But if it's a larger population, then they are unfortunately having to do treatment virtually. But COVID has negatively affected those numbers. I'm hoping that we can kind of get that time frame back. I know it's very taxing on the participants when the program, someone had recently graduated and he said, you know, like we weren't as advertised. We advertised as a 12-month program and it had taken him longer, which is unfortunate, but you know, I don't like to compare. Everybody's on their own journey. So it is what it is.
Well, and you know, when you stop and think about it, in the past year, there were over 107,000 opioid overdose fatalities. Yeah. And you stop and think about that, and you really do think about how during COVID, there was just so much isolation. Mm-hmm. You know, when you think of courthouses were closed, probation departments were closed, and when someone is so isolated, that's when we start to see so many of the issues for those individuals that have substance use disorder.
Yeah. Even locally, I went to a sheriff's town hall in my community, and he had discussed how much the DUIs had increased just during COVID.
Wow.
So I expect business to continue to do well, which is an unfortunate.
Yeah, it is unfortunate.
An unfortunate side effect of having this job.
Right. And Melissa, what about you?
Our DUI court program started in 2017. We're currently at about 15 participants with 7 in what we call the hopper. We are a mandatory court, so anyone on their third or more lifetime DUI will automatically be admitted into the program, as long as they rate out high risk, high needs. But at a certain point in time, you know, they have a need when they've been in treatment for 2, 3, 4 times in their lifetime. Additionally, we are a 5-phase program that is 24 months at minimum length. So we did see an uptick during COVID of the number of participants we enrolled in the program. We actually tripled in capacity from 2020 until now. Wow. Because DUIs aren't stopping. It started with isolation drinking and driving. Now it's becoming more of that social drinking and driving that we, or drug use and driving that we knew pre-COVID. There's a significant issue with, as I previously said, polysubstance abuse. Mm-hmm. People thinking that they are clear-headed enough to drive. And the only reason that they tend to get caught is car accidents, falling asleep behind the wheel with the car running, and somebody reporting it. So thankfully, they haven't done physical harm to somebody else, but they have the propensity to do so. They just happen to be in the right place at the right time.
It's definitely been a tough 2.5 years.
Definitely. Sure. And I would say even with shelter in place, when everybody was drinking at home, they had nothing to do, nowhere to go. And then that increases their tolerance. Mm-hmm. So now that we're all trying to socialize and make up for lost time, the tolerance is higher and we don't understand what we've done to ourselves over the last 2.5 years.
And you know, in our workshop yesterday, we had General McCaffrey speak and he was talking, and I can't remember exactly what he quoted, but even the number of individuals who have died as a result of alcohol during COVID was significantly high, just like the 107 overdose deaths due to opioids.
I've had 2 close in my family this year.
Wow. Oh, so. I'm sorry. Oh. Well, tell me then, as we're talking about substance use disorder, what would you say has been the most valuable thing for you tied to your drug testing program?
I think, as previously mentioned, the knowing of new drug use. So while they're being monitored maybe through a SCRAM or TAD unit for alcohol monitoring, then they pick up a different drug. It could be heroin, cocaine, methamphetamines, and something they may have tried 10, 15 years in the past or never tried before, but they have the opportunity. And we know with addictive behaviors, you can become addicted to whatever new drug you choose. So that has, our drug testing program has shown us how people have evolved their use or tried to hide their use too. Mm-hmm. Additionally, we'll have people during COVID saying they're having COVID-like symptoms, so they took NyQuil. Being able to see if they're actually taking NyQuil at a medicinal level, mm-hmm. or is it actually alcohol use that you're trying to mask as I'm covering up these symptoms. we've seen, you know, a lot of benefit over the just the past few weeks of monitoring pretrial individuals that are eligible for DUI court to see if their levels of marijuana are going down or if they're continuing to use. Many defense attorneys like to say it's a relapse, but in order for a relapse, you have to have a period of remission. Mm-hmm. So drug testing allows us to show a pattern of use instead of, you know, a good break. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And Darcy, what about you as far as your drug testing program? What's really valuable and what, as far as the overall consistency with the program and how it works for you?
Well, just touching up real quick on the substance use disorder, I think one of the things that we've noticed, one of the patterns that I've noticed is that people will, during the assessment, disclose prior drug use history, mm-hmm. and it may have been something that they dabbled with or previously used, but of course they're minimizing their use. So then whenever they come into the program and we take away the alcohol, then they might revert to old habits or old patterns because they're still trying to, you know, get a fix somewhere. And so that's whenever we've really been able to target other substance uses besides the alcohol that we would assume we're, you know, obviously we're looking for that primary issue, when in fact it may not be the primary issue. So that's been beneficial. So we, I'm so grateful that we're able to co-locate with EverHealth and provide drug testing 7 days a week, optional 7 days a week. And my favorite, I was just working recently with the area manager, and we had several positives come up on July 3rd because it was a Sunday. Mm-hmm. The July 4th holiday was a Monday. Mm-hmm. So they kind of assumed, oh, there's not going to be any testing. It's a holiday weekend. Everybody's out. And oh man, did I collect positives on that 3rd. And I just kind of giggled because I was like, oh, those Sunday tests, they're my favorite, or those holiday tests, they're my favorite, because people assume that, you know, oh, the staff is going to have a holiday or they're going to have a break or everything's closed, so we're not going to be testing, but we're able to provide those services and continue to test even during the holidays and even during the breaks. And that really increases our fidelity as a program because mm-hmm. we're holding them accountable. If you're not able to maintain consistent fidelity in the program and hold them accountable, then if they're able to find all of the loopholes in your testing system, then they're going to find all the loopholes in the testing system. Because trust me, I've rewritten my handbook about 1,000 times because every time they find a loophole, I'm going to have to add language or reword it or whatever. And testing is no different. Mm-hmm. So being able to provide those services and make sure that I'm ensuring a high quality in my program, that's critical to me, because then I can hold my head up confidently in the community and say that, yes, this is what I'm doing. And my program adds value to the community because I know that we're producing a quality program. Mm-hmm.
And I think too, you know, when you look at evidence-based practices and mm-hmm. the importance of yeah. drug testing being done following evidence-based practices. Yeah. So you are, like you said, we can test 7 days a week. We can test 365 days a year, yep. weekends and holidays.
Yep.
And having a randomized program
right.
where the client has to call in daily to find out or get text messages that they have to test or they don't test, you know, versus having it scheduled like, oh, I'm going to go in and see my probation officer yep. or my case manager. And I know that when I go in, they're going to test me every time. Well, that to me, obviously, as we all agree, is not part of being an evidence-based drug testing program. It has to be randomized,
yeah.
mm-hmm. you know, and that is the key. And especially for the clients we serve in treatment courts with the high risk, high needs, you know, they've got to be tested approximately 2 to 3 times per week on a randomized schedule.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's so important.
I would add that previous to being with EverHealth, mm-hmm. I had utilized 2 other drug testing companies, and we do our testing in-house. So myself, and then I have 2 staff people that do the observed testing, but we were having to put things in the computer to randomize it. So then mm-hmm. we would get a lot of pushback from mm-hmm. judges and defense that is not really random
right.
because we're inputting that information. And 2, working, you know, Monday through Friday, our clients would know, hey, Monday is a holiday, they're not going to be in, and they would kind of get used to that. Mm-hmm. But now we're able to broaden our spectrum of hours that we operate, randomize it. So we put our information in the calendar, how many tests we can take that week, And they never know, you know, it used to be, oh, Melissa's in Tuesday, Thursday. I'm only going to test on Tuesday, Thursday, because they would memorize my schedule. And like Darcy said, they figure every workaround. But now that we have a completely randomized program, that it's their, the onus is on them to call in instead of calling a voicemail I would leave and say, your color is blue. They have a PIN number.
Right.
The onus is on them to log in, call in, or receive that text message. And it's been so much easier for myself, the staff, and for defense to argue against these test results.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've been participating in drug testing in one way or another, in some fashion or another, for 18 years. And so I've done it all the wrong ways and the right way. And it's much easier the right way. But I can attest, a very long time ago when we had a three color coded system, they would write down every color on the calendar and they would spend hours trying to find the pattern. And so just never underestimate the ingenuity and the determination of an addict, because I mean, even still with the computer randomizer now and everybody having their individual PIN, they still write their test days on the calendar and try and figure out a pattern. And I'm like, it's random.
I don't know.
I don't know how else to say it. The computer's going to just figure it out. You're not going to be able to.
Yeah, in the system. Yeah.
And the other nice part is that, you know, we have a pre-chosen panel. So everyone in our DUI court is going to be tested for the same substances, but that doesn't mean I can't add those specialty drugs as needed. Mm-hmm. You know, my previous experience is I was having to hand pick, you know, which five panels, which 11 panels I wanted. That is time consuming. Yep. It's hard on labor. There's no consistency. Yep. And then it just takes one person. Well, why did I get tested for this, but Mr. Smith didn't get tested for this? And then the fidelity to your program,
right?
You know,
Hours.
Yeah.
Hours. When I switched to Eversys, hours I saved each week. Because, I mean, we were having to change the phone line every night. And then you wake up in the middle of the night with that panic of, did I change the message?
Yeah. Now my only panic is, did I update the calendar? Because I'm at NADCP.
Yeah. Or having to go in and just look at the results. Or also saying, okay, I'm going to customize some panels. I'm going to rotate panels.
Yeah.
And that takes a second. I mean, it doesn't take long.
So nice to be able to just reach out to my account manager and say, hey, I need to update hours. Done.
Yep.
And before it was updating the voicemail. You didn't like how you sounded on the recording. You're re-recording it. Or you're at Christmas dinner. You got to step out of the room and go record the message for tomorrow. And then you have the screaming kid in the background.
Exactly.
I love it. Oh. All right. So let's switch gears a tad and just go to the fact that, you know, the latest statistics show that more than 1,100 people die each year in alcohol-impaired driving crashes. These deaths and countless injuries, as we all know, are 100% preventable. What trends are you seeing in your state, Darcy, and even trends nationwide? Mm-hmm.
So my mom moved to Georgia during COVID, and she has been born and raised and spent her entire life in California. So it was a little bit of a culture shock for her. But one of the things that Georgia does is and I'm sure they do this in other states and probably even in California, but I lived in the suburbs, so I didn't really frequent the freeways very often. But in Georgia, you frequent the freeways daily.
Yes.
So on the freeway, they have like the death toll. Mm-hmm. How many highway deaths have happened, you know, and they restart every January 1 and then they in the toll. And so over the years that I've lived here, it's been kind of fascinating and tragic at the same time to see those trends. And I remember my mom when she saw that number the first time, and she was just kind of shocked and horrified at how many people had died on the highway. So, I mean, I feel like, and this is completely unscientific, but I feel like in the last 2 years, that number has just increased significantly. And again, I mean, we've already kind of had this conversation about COVID and all of the negative effects that it's had on substance use disorder and alcoholism and addiction. But I mean, I see it. I see it in my community. I see it at work. I see it on the road. I see it. So you don't really have to look that hard. It's there.
Well, and so many people, I think, are, you know, you can when I would do presentations on alcohol monitoring and technology and drug driving and drunk driving, you know, I know how some of the statistics were a person dies as a result of a drunk driving crash, mm-hmm. like every 20 some minutes or something like that.
I don't think it's like 26 or something.
26, like 20, yeah, something like that. Yeah. And you just go, oh my gosh.
It's crazy.
You know, when you think that we've been sitting in this room talking and someone has died. Mm-hmm. Something that is totally preventable. Mm-hmm. So it's just, yeah, it's very sad. Melissa, what about you as far as when you look at, you know, alcohol-related crashes, you know, what are some of the things you're seeing in Washington State?
Sadly, it's the repeat offenders. It's the people that have five or more DUIs. And being a Washington native, born and raised, you know, they teach you don't drink and drive from a very young age. We don't have the death tolls on the side of the road, but they do little emphasis patrols and they'll put it on the billboard on the freeway, mm-hmm. emphasis patrol happening. And then the Washington State Patrol or local law enforcement will advertise how many arrests they did over the weekend. And they're not all fatalities, thank God, but any one of those could be a fatality. Mm-hmm. Just because there's an emphasis patrol doesn't stop people. So, you know, there's so many what ifs of there. You know, how do people, I don't like to call it luck that these alcohol or drug involved drivers didn't kill somebody, because it's just one little millisecond later or one little inch. The trends we are seeing are, you know, the polysubstance DUIs, the DUIs or that have high rates of speed attached to them. So it's not only reckless because you're already under the influence and driving, you're taking it to another level and adding a secondary cause, or that could be the primary cause of the collision, and your reactive time is shorter. It's just very disheartening. I sit on impaired driving panels in our state, and the statistics, instead of going down on traffic-related deaths, are going up. Mm-hmm. And we have technology in our favor. Mm-hmm. We use ignition interlock devices. We have DUI courts. You know, we're doing everything in our power, I think, as a court system, as law enforcement, to curb these traffic-related deaths. But it all starts with the individual that's consuming whatever the substance is to make educated decisions. In the age of Uber and Lyft, there should be no reason that we have impaired driving fatalities, but we still do.
Yeah, Uber and Lyft did not exist when I started in this DUI court program 12 years ago. And I think there was a small decrease at a certain point, probably pre-COVID, where people were utilizing those services more, but that has gone kind of by the wayside, and people are going back to their old habits. And I think NHTSA has a statistic out there that, because you had said it's not luck, and it, yeah. and I agree, it's not yeah. luck, because NHTSA statistic says that someone has the probability of driving 200 times yes. drunk yes. before they're first arrested.
Yes.
And that's mind-boggling, yeah. because if you just do simple math, and okay, because I'm terrible at head math, if I have 70 people in my program and they've all driven, and they're all multiple offenders, so they've all driven 200 times before their first arrest, and now they're on their second or third or fourth arrest, mm-hmm. I mean, that is a lot of that's thousands.
People that are on the road
driving.
That they were very fortunate that they didn't
exactly,
you know, get into any
exactly.
kind of a crash. Yeah, exactly. And I would always, that statistic, I remember I would talk about that and you'd say that in a presentation and people would just go,
because it's earth shattering.
You're kidding.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's, you can't wrap your head around
yeah.
it.
Well, and you also have to take into consideration that you do not need to be intoxicated in order to be involved in an impaired driving mm-hmm. collision. You know, buzz driving is drunk
yep.
driving.
Yep.
You could think that you're fine, that you haven't drank for hours, but any level of impairment can impair, you know, that reactivity
yeah.
time. And I think people fail to realize that the most responsible thing to do is to wait. Wait it out.
Yeah.
And we've had
yeah.
several people come into our program who've been arrested for DUI from the morning after. So they just partied so hard, got so drunk the night before. They're driving home the next day.
Thinking they're fine.
Mm-hmm. Thinking that they're
yes.
fine. And they're still, you know, a 0.1 or higher.
Mm-hmm. And that makes you wonder, how much did you have?
Yeah. How much did you drink?
We all know.
And then it goes from public safety to personal safety. So right. I think that is also a goal of DUI courts, is to monitor both the public safety and the personal safety and combine them together. And by monitoring their use through drug testing, it kind of helps us to do that. We know that they're not using. We can see hopefully that they're taking the bus or Uber if they're not licensed. And we can, you know, merge everything together, because especially for these people that have substance use disorders, their whole body has changed because of their addiction. So not only are we bettering them and preventing hopefully future drunk driving, collisions, crashes, arrests, but we're also preparing this person to be a better person in the long run.
Yeah. Well, and a whole different topic about personal safety and just women and treatment and them learning boundaries and self-respect and self-esteem. And
Well, and all the recovery tools that they need to reach recovery.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, recovery is so holistic.
About the whole side of treatment courts, which is what it offers that individual, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let's talk about mental health and the impact. As we all know, with the work that we do, mental health disorder is many times an underlying factor involved, whether with someone who has substance use disorder. What are you seeing in your programs around those individuals, participants that obviously have a SUD, but also the mental health side of it? Lissa, do you want to go first?
I think I am fortunate to live in a very urban area, being in Seattle. So we see a lot of co-occurring disorders, and we see both the people self-medicating with other drug and alcohol use. So the substance use disorders, sometimes the secondary diagnosis. But sometimes the mental health disorder is a secondary diagnosis. But I think they go hand in hand. Absolutely. Because alcohol and drugs can amplify any feelings that we are having. So the anxiety, the stress, the depression, the euphoria. So it's hard to sometimes distinguish, is this just a substance use disorder or is this mental health? And then by bringing in the appropriate clinicians, by identifying the drugs that are in their system or the alcohol that's in their system, we can kind of guide this person to the right level of care and hopefully to greater expectations. On average, about my caseload, 65 to 70% have a co-occurring disorder. So they have a substance use disorder that's moderate to severe, and then some other underlying psychological condition.
Darcy?
Yeah, I would definitely say easily, at least 65% in my program, if not more. So it's predominant in our program, and we just see it time and time again. And most commonly, it's the substance use disorder, and then it's paired with depression or anxiety, or depression and anxiety. So those seem to all really go hand in hand. Certainly we've had a few schizophrenics come through our program and successfully graduate. The key there is really medication management. If they stay consistent with their medication, they can absolutely be successful. We had a lot of concerns with that, because that's a very scary diagnosis, and it's intimidating when you're a DUI court and you're not a mental health court. But we've been successful a few times with that diagnosis, but predominantly depression and anxiety, and that having it be so prevalent in our population kind of helps as far as treatment response, because then when you bring things in like mindfulness and meditation and those types of coping skills into the group atmosphere, then you see a really significant and impactful change in the groups. And so many people talk about the benefit of mindfulness in their therapy sessions. So
I think there's a benefit to having therapeutic courts, and the DUI court model is people realize that they're not alone. Because sometimes when you have a mental health disorder and a substance use disorder, you know, there's that mentality, well, everybody drinks, or, you know, it's just marijuana. But when you have a mental health disorder, a lot of people stigmatize that and keep it to themselves. But once they start hearing other people speak up because they're on the road to recovery, it helps them open up and then realize, maybe I do have a mental health disorder and want to seek, you know, help with that.
Yeah. Well, so much of substance use is self-medication. You know, certainly there's the genetic component and the addiction, the disease of addiction itself, but so much of it really is self-medication as well. So they go hand in hand.
Yeah. Well, I could sit and talk to the two of you so much longer about so many topics, because obviously we know that treatment courts are near and dear to our hearts, the work that we've all done in this field for so many years. I personally want to just thank both of you for being our customer ambassadors at EverHealth, and Melissa, Darcy, and also for joining us here on Recovery Corner. Thank you for all the work that you do in your programs, and for seeing those people reach recovery, because it is incredibly rewarding. And thank you for listening. Join us again for another episode of Recovery Corner.